We'll kind of start slowly. A few people are still coming in, maybe. And could you hear me okay in the back today? Even though through some of the instructions? Was okay? Adequate? Enough? I'm getting these longer eyebrows now as I get older. In Zen, you know, they have Zen masters have these big, you know, bushy eyebrows. And it's like kind of like the Pinocchio principle, you know, that you can't really teach the truth. It's not possible. And so Zen masters are kind of, they get these big, long eyebrows because they're always teaching so much and really missing the point. So I noticed they're getting these long it's happening to me now. So, and also, maybe not now, but it would be nice if some of you gave some feedback about how it was to include yoga in a day like today. Some of you did it and how that was to include it, and some of you didn't do it, and how was it like to go off on your own and not be part of something that was being offered. Just so, I think my general feeling is it's probably very nice and helpful. We might do it occasionally. But nice to hear from you, so you come up to me and tell me at some point. And also, it was new to have these kinds of divide up the different people, relatively new people and under 2 year people and over 2 year people, and have these little kind of group meetings through the day, and how that was for some of you to do that. And I thought it was quite nice to do it as an option for people. And what else? To any kind of announcement? There's some flyers up there on the table. The next one day sitting that we're going to do here in Palo Alto is in July. And Julie Wester, who's a great teacher, one of the teachers at Spirit Rock, and she leads a lot of women's retreats. And she's agreed to come down to Palo Alto and lead a women's retreat down here for us, a one-day retreat for women. And it's going to be July 20th. And it will not be here, but rather it'll be at the other place where we have our meetings, at the Friends Meeting House. And the address and everything is on the flyers. So I think that should be quite nice. But I'll never know. And, okay. Oh, and then for the men who are interested, you know, who, then everybody can come. Again, on August 17th. So the men have to wait a little while. Couple of months. And August 17th, we'll meet here again in this room. And Wes Nisker, who's a teacher who lives in Berkeley and a very interesting man, will come and lead a one-day sitting for us. Okay. So what I wanted to do today was to actually tell you a story, tell you a myth. And the modern myth about myths, or the modern story about myths, is that you can take myths as all the different characters of a myth as being yourself, different aspects of yourself. So that's one way of looking at them or incorporating them. But I like to think of that as the modern myth about myths. And this is an old myth that is, you know, goes back. You know, it's before Freud and before the Gospel and Genesis and before the Old Testament, and it's a Sumerian story that's probably about 4,000 years old. So in some ways it's one of the earliest myths we have of our Western culture. And it's a story of Inanna, I think you pronounce her name, and she's the Queen of Heaven. And the Queen of Heaven decided to go visit the underworld, the world below. And the way the text says it, she decided to put her ear to the great below. Kind of a nice image, to put her ear to the great below, to go below. And so she puts on her crown, and she puts on her great robe, and she puts on her necklace and her bracelets and her breast armor and her regalia, and then she goes to a friend and says, "I'm going to the underworld. But if I'm gone for more than 3 days, please come down and come and get me, help me out. It means I'm stuck down there or something." So she goes to the first gate. There's seven gates to the underworld. She comes to the first gate, and the gatekeeper says, "Who's there?" And she says, "It's me. It's the Queen of Heaven, Inanna, and I'm going down to see my sister." And her sister is, maybe some of you know how to pronounce it, but I know it as Irshigal. Irshigal, you know it, sorry. So Irshigal. Irshigal is the queen of the underworld, her sister. So the gatekeeper says, "Wait a minute here." And the gatekeeper goes to Irshigal and says, "Your sister Inanna is here, and what should we do?" And so Irshigal is described as having hair like leeks, and is wild, you know, and full of fiery fury and pain and whatever. And she says, "Oh, great, let her in." And she licks her teeth. So the gatekeeper goes back and says, you know, she says to Inanna, "You know, anybody who comes in here through these gates is never able to leave again." And so Inanna says, "I want to go in anyway." Over. But Irshigal, before she agrees to let her sister in, she says, "Let her in, but as she goes through each gate, she has to take off one of her things she's wearing, because she needs to come to the underworld naked and bowed, in humility, I guess." So Inanna decides to go through, even though she's told she can never come back. But before she goes through, the first gatekeeper takes off her crown. And she says, "What are you doing?" And she said, "This is the way of the underworld. You have to. The ways of the underworld are perfect, and it requires you to take off your crown." So she goes into the next gate, and the same thing. She takes off something else, her necklace. And finally, she comes in front. She goes through the seven gates, and they're locked behind her as she goes through. And she comes finally to the underworld, and she's there naked. She's left there all her coverings behind. And she comes to the underworld, to the court of her sister, and her sister sees her, and her sister steps down to meet her, walks up to her. And as she does that, the judges of the underworld condemn Inanna to death. And things happen very quickly down there. So she dies, and then she's hung up her corpse, which is just a kind of a dry, just kind of a bag of skin. That's all that's left, just this dried skin, is hung up on the wall of the great chamber of the underworld. I think she partly celebrates, but partly she's racked then with pain, and she's filled with pain and suffering. And the pain is described as like the pain of giving labor, like she's giving birth. And it's great pain. So after 3 days, and this friend who's left back up in heaven remembers, you know, Inanna hasn't come back. So her friend goes to some of the other gods in the heaven and says, you know, Inanna has not come back. And the god says, "Well, Inanna went on her own free will to the underworld, so we're not going to help her. Leave her down there." So finally she goes, the helper goes to Enki, and Enki is the god of nature, and says, you know, "Inanna, the queen of heaven, you know, has not come back from the underworld. Can't you go and do something to help?" And Enki, the god of nature, decides to help. And it's, I don't know, quite it's kind of a strange image, but he takes dirt from underneath his fingertips, and he fashions two little creatures from this dirt. And it's said that they're neither female or male. They're just kind of androgynous, I guess, or whatever. And he gives one of them the water of life, and the other one the food of life. And he says, "You guys fly down like little flies and fly down through the lock of the gates and fly through and go into the inner chamber. And when you find Irshigal there in her suffering, just buzz around her. And when she says, 'Oh, my suffering,' or 'Oh, my body hurts,' or 'Oh, this is terrible,' just repeat it to her. And say, when she says, 'Oh, my body hurts,' just say, 'Oh, your body hurts. Oh, my suffering. Oh, your suffering. Oh, you know, whatever.' Just repeat it to her, just gently. And when she hears that someone is compassionately kind of concerned and hears what's going on with her, she's going to offer you a gift. And when she offers you a gift, ask for that corpse of Inanna that's hanging on the wall. So these little flies, these little creatures fly in there and do that. And Urshagal says, "Oh, my suffering." And little creatures say, "Oh, your suffering. Oh, my poor knee that hurts. Oh, your knee hurts. Oh, my self-pity. Oh, your pity. My back, you know, you name it. You probably had your chance to do that today." And it's a very compassionate thing just to be present and to be attentive and to notice the suffering. Just, oh, and call it by name. Suffering, pain, anger, grief, sadness. You know, just to call it. So sure enough, Urshagal says, "Oh, who are these compassionate creatures? And you know, what can I give you?" And they ask for the corpse. And as soon, she says, "Oh, the corpse, you can have it, you know, whatever you wish." And so as soon as they're given the corpse, they take it down from the hook on the wall, and one of them gives it the water of life, and the other gives it the food of life, and Inanna comes back to life. And so then Inanna starts to leave the underworld, but then it turns out it isn't that no one can ever leave the underworld, but the rule is no one can leave the underworld without leaving a substitute to replace them. So the demons of the underworld follow her out and say, you know, you have to provide someone who's going to be your replacement. And so they leave the underworld and they come to this person, this friend of Inanna. And Inanna says, "Oh no, it can't be that person, it's my friend." And then they come across this person, and Inanna says, "No, it can't be that person." They come across her sons or her children who've been in mourning because Inanna's left or it's gone. And died. And so they say, "Well, we'll take your children." He says, "No, you can't take my children. They're in mourning. I love them. You can't take them." And finally they go through all these different people, and finally they come to the court where Inanna and her husband rule, and they find her husband there, I guess the king of the heavens or whatever. But their husband didn't mourn her absence. Actually was kind of happy, I guess. You know. And so the demons see the husband and say, "We'll take him." And the husband runs away. And so the demons chase. And apparently the story, as I've heard it, you know, there's a long piece where they describe this chase of the husband. And finally the husband comes to the house of his sister and takes refuge there, but they get him anyway and take him down to the underworld. But Inanna isn't so happy about this arrangement after all. And so she goes to the sister of the husband's and asks her if can't she go down and take turns with her brother. And so 6 months of the year, the sister goes down to the underworld and lives there. And 6 months of the year, the husband goes down to live there. They kind of alternate. And so that's the story. And it's a kind of, you know, interesting story. So how do we take all these parts to be ourselves, how do we take them to be ourselves? You know, and that's kind of the task, the homework. And first, I think it's nice, you know, that she wanted to go down to the underworld. You know, she put her ears to the great below. And I think in some ways in meditation, that's what we do, is we're going to go into the unknown. The underworld maybe is the unknown. And the present moment is the unknown, because the present moment is just the present moment. The before and after, what's next, we don't know. Who are we in the present moment? Really fully in the present moment, who are we? We don't really know. So there's a willingness to go into the unknown and to explore that, to explore the depth of it or whatever might arise in the midst of it. And that's in part what, you know, one way we can describe a retreat is we go into the unknown. We go into to discover what it is. To be present, to be alive, to give voice, to listen deeply to what's actually here. And then she puts on all her regalia of her identity. She puts on her crown, and, you know, things which are her birthright, I guess. The things, you know, maybe some of it and some maybe not. She puts on her identity, her clothes. And I think what's asked of us as we practice is, at least for a period of our time, not necessarily always, but for a period of practice, is to be willing to put away all the different things we put on top of ourselves, we add to ourselves to form an identity. And to appear, in a sense, metaphorically, at least naked and exposed. To have enough trust and enough willingness to let go of the things we have on to protect ourselves, to defend ourselves, to project ourselves into the world in a certain way. So as you went through these seven gates, it's kind of like going through the seven periods of a day in meditation there. It's just going through the progressive letting go that has to happen for us to really be intimate with ourselves and allow these deeper parts of us to be. And then she comes, and there's a kind of a dying that happens. And that takes many forms, a kind of total letting go. The image of dying seems very powerful, kind of a little bit grotesque, you know, to hang your corpse up on a hook in the wall, dry corpse. But she meets her sister, and her sister, you know, there's, you know, the two parts of herself, perhaps, of ourselves. You know, there's parts of ourselves which are full of energy and wild and fiery and maybe uncompassionate. Who knows what the shadow sides are or what the different parts of ourselves are. But we give room for it. We allow it to be there. We go visit it. We meet it. And maybe the meeting isn't always pleasant. And maybe sometimes the shadow sides of ourselves, the parts of ourselves which are angry or full of grief or that maybe are not necessarily compassionate, that maybe actually destroy even parts of ourselves which are wholesome. We allow it to do that, to see it clearly, allow it to be there. And then we bring the wonderful compassionate practice of mindfulness to all that, to really see who we are. We see the pains of ourselves, the pain of labor, something new gets born. So we bring our mindfulness to see our pain, the suffering of who we are when we're quite attentive and open ourselves up. And we simply are attentive to it. And I think it's wonderful, this myth, this ancient myth, simply says, pay attention to the pain, to the suffering. Call it for what it is. Oh, my suffering. Oh, your suffering. I think it's tremendously healing to do that. Just call it for what it is. And just allow it to be and see what happens. To see ourselves, to bring the gift, the blessing of attention to who we are. And then doing that brings back life, the rebirth that happens. Maybe that's the pain of labor that Erskine was feeling, was this new birth that was going to come. And we don't know, and I think oftentimes practice, intense practice, is a kind of rebirthing, some new stuff that gets born. Maybe it's just simply as what gets born is our compassion for ourselves. And then there's a coming then back into light, coming back into the regular world, back into heaven. And I find it very interesting. I don't know what to make of all this myth, but I find it very interesting that Inanna couldn't just come back clean. That's it, you're back in heaven. But there had some part of her had to always go back and visit, to always be there in the underworld or in the shadow world. Had to stay connected with that part of oneself. And so there was an arrangement made. And so I don't know what arrangements you guys make. But you know, she sent her husband. And her husband's sister. So I think it's a very interesting myth. And I think it seems to me tie into one way of understanding a spiritual practice that we have here. You don't have to use the myth to understand it. There's other myths we can use. But what do you think of that? Do you think? Do you feel a connection between your practice and your life and even what you did here today and this going into the great below and meeting different aspects of oneself, letting go of different aspects of yourself in order to go really deep and then meeting areas of great suffering and being compassionate and being reborn? What did you make of that myth? Do you recognize it, identify with it?
I thought Inanna's clothing was like, or her regalia, her crown and all that stuff. To me, that was like the commentary that runs through my head. I think that's how I build up my own identity, is through this, you know, these random things that keep going through my head, and they're still there, and they're going to stay there. But I like them being there because it builds up who I am. I have a really hard time letting go of it.
Uh-huh. And so maybe you don't have to let go of it once and for all. Maybe it has some function even that's maybe actually healthy. But it'd be very nice if once, at least once, you can give yourself a chance to find out what's there. when the commentary is not there, supporting a sense of who you are and creating who you are and the world who you are. And so to go through all seven gates and take off all this commentary as you go. And one of the ways to do that is to really be intent on following your breath, really kind of doing the practice very intently with great bravery. It takes tremendous courage. What would it be like to really let go of all this thing stuff and find out what it would be like not to have any commentary, to have the mind meeting the world fresh and clean? Any ideas of who I am, what the world is, without resistance, without fear. And to really kind of, in a sense, metaphorically, go naked. And the myth is kind of interesting because it isn't simply going naked into the world, but it's actually going naked into the underworld. And perhaps the underworld, the shadow side, requires us to go in naked, not to have the identity, not to have the resistance, maybe. Bill?
You talking about being naked, there was a period of time in my life, I don't know if people can guess what time that was, in which people were seriously clothing optional. I got to a point very early on because my father was very much that way. He was a man who didn't care what particularly what he wore and when he wore it or whether he was naked or not. He once said that his greatest ambition was to have a house in which he could go out in the morning naked and clothes on. So I grew up with a sense of not feeling embarrassed about not having any clothes on, which was reinforced during that period. And in the intervening time, I have developed a sense of, I guess, false modesty, I would call it. But I can remember times in my life being very comfortable that way, that it didn't matter. It didn't matter whether I was in shape or what I looked like or any of these things. Sitting here this afternoon, it seems to be a place that I want to get back to appropriately.
Yeah, please. I think that being excessively self-conscious about how we look is one of the great places where we limit ourselves and cut ourselves off from ourselves. And, you know, I talked about this more early in the morning about body image from the outside versus body image from the inside. And I think in mindfulness we're learning to come from the inside rather than these ideas on the outside. And there is some sadness. And for me there's a little bit of sadness in that our culture has changed. I grew up also with my family attitude was kind of the same about nudity. It was very relaxed and there was nothing special about it at all. It's just who we were. But when I was very young, it was explained to me that by my parents that you have to be a little bit careful because people, society around you didn't have the same attitude. So that was okay with me. But then I grew up in the late 60s and early 70s, you know, and it was a great time. There was parts of it that were really beautiful. And I look back nostalgically, I had a little sadness that some of the healthy, what I thought was really healthy parts of the counterculture, the culture that I was part of, it's not possible anymore. It's just not easy anymore. Nudity was one of them. And there was all this nudity happening. And no one thought of it twice, at least, you know. And maybe there was some abuse of it too, but I was so comfortable. We were all so comfortable with each other's nudity. And this almost doesn't happen anymore, that I'm in environments with other people where we're comfortable with each other's nudity. And that's a little bit sad, I feel. The culture has changed and shifted. So, you know, partly who I am is I'm in response to the culture I'm in. And I don't want to hurt people, I don't want to upset people. So I'm willing to go along to some degree with also, you know, I'm pretty comfortable with my nudity, but I'm not going to do what I did in the 60s because the people around me don't seem so comfortable. So it's for their sake. And so there's a kind of give and take between that I think comes from sensitivity to others. That's kind of give and take. We don't necessarily do things just for ourselves, but there's sensitivity how other people are also. But the negotiation of that sometimes, hopefully we do it in a way that's honest and doesn't cut ourselves off from who we are. And happen anyway. It's... Thank you. Yes?
In the myth, I was drawn to the food and water, little bugs or flies or whatever they were. And I liken that to what you said earlier today, to the medicine that's all around us. And compare that to how we can be revivified by the medicine that's all around us, if we're aware of it, in the same way that those two little bugs could go any place and revivify the corpse.
Beautiful. Thank you. So what does it take to see the world as medicine?
I think the other one is saying that what you said about meditation really touched me.
Did I say the word?
It touched me because I was with my sister. My family that I was a parent of was very comfortable with meditation. And I remember that my mother was very comfortable, but my father wasn't, and I was never comfortable around my father with meditating. I just felt a lot of sadness. But other than that, what I wanted to say about the myth is that it speaks to me so profoundly. And I once heard that myth spoken of as also the journey of illness. That when we're ill, that we actually enter. We have to, the part of the healing is stripping ourselves, maybe aging too, of the trappings of our personality and the way we want to present ourselves, the way we think we're supposed to be seen. And that always, that spoke to me. And I, when I was ill, I was in a program that helped me to very profoundly go enter into those dark places. And one of the methods that they used was this mirroring. So whenever I spoke, all they did was
speak back,
feed it back. And I learned that form of communication, that when people speak to me, to just acknowledge that. I don't need to do anything else. But that's the healing, is to be heard. And so profoundly that, that as we do this, when we strip our personality, in some ways we are just, we're lifeless, until we bring compassion to the inner part of us, to that deepest part, and to the parts that maybe were dark, that we put away, that we don't allow ourselves, that are not acceptable either to society or to ourselves or to the people around us, maybe more specifically. And that's what brings life back in the healing that allows us to go back out.
So we do it. We do it in our mindfulness practice by ourselves.
And that we do that to ourselves.
We do it to ourselves.
It's like when we feel something or we experience something, whatever the darkest, nastiest, to say, "Oh,
darkness."
That's what's going on.
Yeah, and it's very powerful.
With compassion.
So, that made a question: those compassionate little beings, little flies, why do they come from underneath the dirt from the fingernails? Of the earth, that way? So they, okay. That's good. I was thinking that that the dirt in the fingernail is often inconsequential. You kind of throw it away right away. But perhaps the earth, perhaps compassion is, we often see it as being inconsequential. And we're so quick to kind of throw it away. And but actually, something so inconsequential is the little dirt. Is what compassion is. Compassion is actually quite consequential. Something like that. Yes?
Could it be that, I don't know about their culture, but in our culture it's not okay to have dirt under your fingers. And so it's like the paradox of turning something that was not acceptable into something that was very beautiful.
Turning poison into medicine.
It's It seems like an agricultural myth, or a myth that came in an agricultural time, so I don't know if they had the same stigma about that.
Uh-huh. Because it's somebody working with the earth, like a farmer or something.
Right.
So they're connected to the earth.
Yeah.
That was said. It was just a... Curious, is this a summer, winter myth? Because of the movement between the underworld.
Oh, I was wondering that too. I don't know any more than that, what I've told you. It's about all I know.
But like Persephone.
Mm-hmm. What?
The Greek myth of Persephone goes to the underworld, and then she ends up going 6 months, and that's winter, and then
yeah,
back.
It makes sense.
And they were an agricultural
Nelson, yeah.
Mm-hmm. The association I'm having to the dirt under the nail, there's some transparency when you see it. And maybe it represents a part of our dark side that's always with us. And we kind of get used to having things under our nails, having things that are distasteful always there. And then we become so familiar that we don't need to.
When I met with the with one of the groups today, a lot of the people there talked about how difficult it was to be here today for one day sitting. Difficult emotions, difficult body stuff. You know, it's a tremendous challenge. This practice, and I think somehow for me this myth, the imagery of the myth of going into the underworld and the gates and shedding of identity, it's a tremendous challenge. I think at times it takes tremendous courage to do it, and I think a lot of people come to a spiritual practice, to Buddhism here in the West in California, a little bit with new age idealism. You know, it's all light and great and shiny and and peaceful and whatever, and certainly that's part of it, but that there is beauty and compassion and love and things to be discovered. But it's a whole life. The whole world is medicine. It's the whole balanced stuff of the full spectrum of who we are. And so I like this myth because it shows the challenge of the practice also. Anything else that should be said before we finish the day? Any last thoughts about this myth or about the day or questions? Yes?
Well, it's interesting that it was the Queen of Heaven, and I think a place of light, who wanted to hear, put her ear to the ground, and wanted to know what was underneath. It wasn't the Queen of the Underworld who wanted to appreciate something else.
No.
She was, and it's not what the story's about, but the movement happened because there was this openness. And I suppose it's intended that even though the journey into the underworld is healing and broadening and something we do in our lives, and whether we do or not, we'll end up doing it, that is, if we do it willingly or not. But that this other place is dark and narrow, and we don't move about and think of possibilities. Like, I wonder what it would be like if, or what would this be about? So the person who started things did come from light.
Yeah, and light, I mean, awareness sometimes is described metaphorically as light. So you have to you bring the awareness with you down into the darkness. The darkness doesn't have much chance of maybe, doing much. But I liked also the idea of light. Also, this idea of being in heaven is kind of seems like a very holistic or healthy place to start. And the idea of putting on all her regalia, her crown and everything, it's actually, I mean, it's a beautiful image. It's an image of kind of starting off whole, or starting off with a healthy sense of self, perhaps, or a balanced sense of self, or with all this goodness. I think it is not just. I don't think of her as being an ego trip. I think Inanna as being someone who's kind of putting on all her goodness, the best that she could, being the best person she could be, best person ethically, the best person compassionately, the best person, and bringing all the best that you are. You go into that underworld, and you have to shed. You might have to shed all that, but you don't have to deny it. Does that make sense? Yes.
There's also an echo of Prince Siddhartha leaving the castle for the first time, mm-hmm. and experiencing sickness and death for the first time.
Yeah. And many people don't really practice seriously until they really have confronted some of these things for themselves in a thorough way. Someone in the back, I saw a hand.
Relate to the getting down there and then there's instantly coming to today. Going kill her instantly and hang her up.
That's what today was like? The morning and the afternoon. Did little flies come visit?
After we met, it was like the little flies, just reminding, repeating back, and then we got it's so hard.
Happy birthday. thank you all very much, and thanks to Terry for coming and doing yoga. It was very generous. Thank you. And thank you all for coming. It was very generous to come. And next time I do a one-day sitting here will be in September. And the next one will be, pretty sure the September one, because we alternate when I do them, between this kind like we did today, which is what it was, and then ones which are more for experienced people. There's no instruction given at all, and it's just a day of silence. And then I put up a sheet, a sign-up sheet, and people do 15-minute. If they want, they can do 15-minute interviews. If not too many people sign up. And so anyway, that's what's happening. Also, we could get. We need to fold up the chairs again and put them in the corners. And if someone wants to volunteer to sweep the floor. That also would be nice, just to kind of offer the room back in a nice shape to the Unitarians. Thank you again.